Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, celebrating lots of events in London this year, from the Olympics to the Queen's Jubilee, and much more. We hear about one saint Catholics and Anglicans hold dear, and some dazzling melodies to celebrate his memory. But first, as the Paralympics get underway in the UK, we hear from one Catholic family who finds joy and celebration in having a special needs child. They're fast becoming one of the world's endangered species. They account for about one out of every 730 live births. But if a child is diagnosed with Down syndrome in the womb, there's up to a 95% chance he will be aborted. Down syndrome, or trisomy 21, occurs when an extra chromosome appears in the fetus's genetic makeup, and what causes it is generally unknown. Nearly 80% of Down syndrome cases occur in women younger than 35. It can affect people of all ages, races, and economic levels. While the chance for Down syndrome is known to increase with the mother's age, many women opt for prenatal screening, such as amniocentesis, to test for genetic irregularities. But such tests are not always conclusive and can sometimes cause miscarriage. Art historian Elizabeth Leves is a name familiar to many of our listeners. She's a frequent contributor to our programs. But what people may not know is that Liz has a young son born with Down syndrome, and that she frequently writes articles to raise awareness about the disorder. She spoke to me on her son Joshua's 9th birthday about the beauty and the challenges of having a child with Down syndrome.
When I was pregnant with my son Joshua, who is 9. The doctor, who knows me very well, looked at me. I was of that age. I had just entered into that age where the possibility of a child with genetic defects, particularly trisomy 21, gets much higher. And he said, "There's no point in asking you to do amnio now, is there?" And I said, "No, because I'll take it as it comes." And the fact is that when Joshua was born, I had no idea that he had Down syndrome. I was not really prepared for it. But the fact is that had I to do it again, had I to know, it would have been, I don't think I would change a thing. The fact is there are two different ways of doing it. It depends a lot on the kind of person you are. I think I would have spent the next 9 months planning and worrying and reading books and getting ready and convincing myself that things were going to go one way. I think the way that I chose was that I was going to have this child anyway, and that I would sort of figure it out as it went along, and I would spend those 9 months not worrying and thinking about all the potential problems, which is what doctors always seem to present to you when it comes back with a diagnosis of trisomy 21, the many, many types of birth defects, whether problems with the heart or gastrointestinal system, the problems with getting around the retardation. I mean, spending all this time kind of wondering what might be in a negative sense, I thought it might be nice to spend my 9 months waiting for my child, thinking of what might be in a positive sense. And so I had to do a lot of scrambling to try to figure things out. But frankly, the Italian system was very helpful in getting him inserted into a kind of preparatory therapy type care system.
You've called Down syndrome children an endangered species. Why are they worth saving, in your view?
One of the things that struck me, I forget what sparked this, but I was reading something about some endangered species and the incredible lengths that people will go to save, you know, something that's furry or slimy or scaly or whatever, simply because there aren't very many of them and they're very important for the world's ecosystem. And I don't understand why a human child is somehow considered less than a scaly frog. I mean, I don't understand why a human child, who for what reason? Because the child may potentially have some sort of physical defect that requires surgery? Is it because the child will never conform to the level of intelligence that we seem to think is appropriate, which I think might be very optimistic if we look seriously at the way people use their intelligence? What is it that makes these children somehow less important than an animal? And so these children are these people, not just children. These are people who are endangered. This is an entire group of people with a set and symptoms which revolving around the trisomy 21 who are systematically systematically aborted before they can make it into this world. If that's not, I'll use genocide, I'll use endangered species, I'll use whatever it takes because that's exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at a group of people that the world thinks it can exterminate as if it were a form of bubonic plague, which Down syndrome, trisomy 21, it is not bubonic plague. It is these people are people first and foremost. And they are people with very special, unique, and wonderful gifts on top of everything else. Would people take the time to get to know them?
You, of course, have had 9 years to get to know Joshua. And I've heard so many people say that there is no love like that of a child with special needs. What are some of the memorable moments that you've shared with your son?
Well, what I would say about Joshua, and of course this is one child among the many, but not as many as there should be, of Down syndrome people, but I would find one of the things I find very special about Joshua is that Joshua really does understand an unconditional love. I mean, in a way that he is Caritas. He offers his hand, he offers his affection, he doesn't speak. And so his outpouring of warmth and affection, which is sincere and true always, is very spontaneous, and he leads us into places where perhaps society tells us, well, we can't be kind and reach out and hold hands with, you know, the person randomly sitting on the bus. And yet when Joshua puts his little hand in, you know, a stranger's hand, all of a sudden that person melts. I think in particular of a friend who, getting older, getting considerably older, when people hit a certain age, you start to not know about how to touch them and how to, you know, you're worried about breaking them, you're worrying about, you just don't know how to physically communicate. So you may speak a little louder, you may be more gentle, but you don't reach up and hug. And I remember my son just sort of piercing right through that and walking right up to this person and giving this person a big hug, who on top of everything else has a lifelong diffidence towards people with mentally handicapped people. And so there comes my son, the only person who will pierce through this and will embrace him. And I began to notice that as the time went on, every time Joshua came into the room, he would ready himself, but with a sense of excitement and anticipation. Here is somebody who will hug him. Here is somebody who will just stand next to him, who doesn't see what everybody else sees in a, well, gosh, he's, I don't know if I should. And just gives him simple human warmth. And that is a gift.
You've said yes to the life of your son, but you've done it now with the knowledge also that it's going to mean a lifetime of treatment, of special education, of preparation for what will happen when you're no longer here. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen to him? Doesn't that worry you?
It worries me a great deal. What really worries me is with taking him from place to place to try to find therapy for him, to try to find people who can help him speak, people who can try to understand, to help me understand how to make him learn. I keep encountering a sort of lack of record keeping regarding, and I'm not the only person. I've spoken to other mothers, other parents in similar situations.
Talking about here in Italy.
Here in Italy, but also in the United States to some extent. There seems to be a certain dearth of records kept about how trisomy 21 people learn and how they can learn, because of course it's across the board. It's a very, very wide scale. And actually, up until mid-century, these people were kept in institutions, so there was nothing to be learned at that point. Nobody cared to learn. Then, as Dr. Lejeune began to really make a huge effort to bring these people into society and try to help them in France,
mm-hmm.
Yes, he's tried to help them be inserted into society, which Europe, I must say, did originally a very good job of getting involved with. But we find that all these years later, there are not enough records, and there's certainly not a sense of, let's try this outside of the Lejeune Center, which is about the only place that really takes this situation as a situation that will continue in time. The rest of the establishments and the institutions that I have been to seem to treat the Down syndrome child as that single case that pops up, but with an idea that there's no need to keep the records because eventually that will no longer be a problem. And that was a very chilling thought. But on the other hand, and that's why I wrote the piece about all these optimistic, happy stories, there are, you know, young men and women who are becoming actors, which frankly is important because people see them. It becomes part of their lives. It's not, well, what's wrong with that person? But, oh, yes, I know. That person has trisomy 21. Oh, like that really nice character on Glee. And they learn to incorporate these people in their understanding of humanity. And there is here in Rome, the Comunità of Sant'Egidio has actually a restaurant, a pizza place, where they specifically use young men and women with trisomy 21 in order to as jobs. So there are options, and there's a great deal of creativity to insert these young people into a life. And then there are many very positive centers. What was that one I was reading about? Eva Longoria, who came up with a great idea of a center where they can hang around, be friends, make friends, have activities.
Now, she's an actress on that series, Desperate Housewives.
I must admit, I've never watched her television show, and I'm afraid even this isn't going to make me watch it. But I do. I instead of raising an eyebrow every time I see her name, saying, "Isn't she on that show with a strange name?" I mean, it's wonderful to find out that, you know, you sort of dismiss these people as superficial, but really, she's made a very huge commitment on exactly the point that you were bringing up. Eva Longoria's concern is that when she's not around and her mother's not around, what happens to her sister? And so she created these centers, a center which hopefully will spread, maybe across the Atlantic and get over here, but make these centers where these people can find a social base that will accept them even when they don't have the immediate family members around to take care of them.
Despite the really worrying statistics regarding people who decide to abort their child if they find out that it's going to be a down child or with physical handicaps or so on, it seems that society has been sort of opening up, at least, has been towards people with special needs. I mean, we used to hear the word retarded, but now we hear mentally challenged. We used to hear the word handicapped, and now it's either disabled or physically challenged. So it seems that society is sort of becoming more accepting, at least on the outside. What do you say about that?
I find political speak. I find politically correct speak. It's just a mask. I don't feel like people have become any more accepting because they found a different term for it. I mean, you might be able to call me, falling under that same heading of things that will be less offensive, is that insane BC to CE stuff. It's just a BCE or whatever it is. I mean, I find that switching around the language is a way of kind of putting up cards on the table. I do understand, and I very much sympathize with the work, particularly with the Best Buddies, to end the use of the word retarded, simply because it's just used in such a negative fashion. But that's not what the problem. That's not where the problems in this lie. The problems lie in two things, as far as I can see, is that this modern age of the reduced demographics in Europe, where we have very few children, and in the United States, where we have this sort of a very strong. This is leaving aside really the bulk of the United States who live good lives, but there's a real sort of glitzy culture of the child as accessory. And so the child is, along with your BMW, your bag, your fancy bag, your fancy car, your child is another perfect extension of you. That is not what a child is. Your child is not genetically ordered. You don't custom order it from the maker in order to have it as something you can carry around and say, look how perfect I am. I even have the perfect child. That is not what a child is. That is not what parenthood is. And the fact that we see so much of it is already one of the greatest dangers to these trisomy people or any child, any, a deaf child, a blind child, any child with any kind of defect that doesn't fall into the heading of perfect. And then secondly, this fear. I'm not going to be able to handle it. I'm not going to be able to handle it. I'm not going to be able to handle it. Well, be not afraid, said Blessed John Paul II. Be not afraid. If you are willing to try, God will, the Holy Spirit will come the rest of the way. I am a single parent.
With three children.
And when my son was born, I looked at it, I said, well, wow, this is going to be interesting. And yet, 9 years later, My daughters are more responsible because of the fact that we all had to pitch in and help Joshua. We learn about things that are more important than ourselves. Just as my daughters are becoming adolescents and it's all me, 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 they had to shift to Joshua, 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 and it has helped them. It has helped me in my understanding of what to expect. I have a very smart daughter. I have a very beautiful daughter. I have these expectations like all parents do. And yet when Joshua manages to get himself dressed in the morning, the sense of, wow, look what he did. I mean, he's nine and he got dressed. I'm like, wow, look, we finally did it. Your sense of accomplishment and what an accomplishment is changes. And I can tell you that feels really good. And so you may think that you're the super overachiever. And how can you have a child who's not going to be a super overachiever? But I'll tell you what, that child will teach you a lot about what achieving really is.
A warm thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, an art historian with Duquesne University. Well, though Joshua won't be taking part in the Paralympics underway in London, many other young people with Down syndrome and other disabilities are there, determined to shine and show the world their setbacks won't keep them back from achieving the very highest goals. And London has seen it all this year. The Paralympics and the Olympics in July, and the Queen's Diamond Jubilee celebrating 60 years since her coronation. But how many of you knew that London is celebrating two other landmark events this year?
Greenwich has become a royal borough, an honour bestowed by Her Majesty the Queen in her Diamond Jubilee year. It's also the millennium of our patronal saint, St Alphege, who was martyred in 1012, and here we are in 2012. And of course, the small matter of the Olympic Games has been rather exciting in Greenwich and Greenwich Park, particularly the equestrian events.
As you heard, Greenwich, the site of a big part of the Olympic events, was recently made a royal borough, and it's home to St. Alphege's Anglican Church, celebrating 1,000 years since the martyrdom of its patron saint. Stephen Dagg is the director of the St. Alphege Choir. I met him here in Rome as he was leading the group of professional singers in a series of concerts in the Eternal City and just north in Lake Country. But just who was St. Alphege? I had never heard of him before I met Stephen and his choir. And who better to ask than the vicar of St. Alphege's church?
He was Archbishop of Canterbury, and he was martyred by the Vikings in 1012. So we've just celebrated the millennium of his martyrdom on the 19th of April this year. And we did that with the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was known best for the manner of his death, because he refused to have a ransom paid for his life. He didn't want to impoverish the people of his diocese. He was killed just out of rage and frustration, because they weren't able to get any money for him. And they were also worried, I think, about the influence that this holy man was having on their own supporters. And so they got tired of carting them around with them, and in the end, at a feast, they stoned him to death using bones rather than stones. And it was the manner of his death and the fact that he had done it to protect his people which he's most remembered for.
That's Vicar Christopher Moody, who gave me a bit of background on St. Alphege. I discovered this saint was the first Archbishop of Canterbury to die a violent death. He was canonized by Pope Gregory VII in the year 1078, and his feast day is celebrated April 19th.
The legacy that he's left has been one of concern for non-violence, in that he refused to protect himself or to curse his captors, and also a legacy of social justice, because it was because of his concern for the poor of his diocese that he basically he allowed himself to be killed. And he left a legacy not just in our country, but also in terms of our links with the Scandinavians. There was general revulsion about his death, which brought both the Danes and the Saxons together just briefly. And then when the first king, Danish king of England, came, he elevated his cult by taking his body back to Canterbury. And so a shrine was set up in Canterbury. So that was a sign of reconciliation between the Vikings and the Saxons.
Now, is he strictly seen as as an English saint?
No, he is known throughout the Universal Church, and it was before the schism, so he's venerated in the East as well as the Western Church. He's venerated in the Eastern Church because they discovered when they moved his body that it hadn't corrupted at all. So that was another sign of his sanctity. So he is a saint of the whole church.
But Father Chris, as he likes to be called, isn't just an Anglican vicar. He's also part of the St. Alphage Choir that was touring Rome. And now take a seat and lean back and enjoy some of the strains of such great 16th century English composers as Thomas Tallis and William Byrd, sung here by Vicar Chris and his 24-strong choir of St. Alphage Church, directed by Stephen Dagg.
Oh,
I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening.
Laudator Jesus Christus.